The heavenly fire calls us and we come. Move away from Jace Lightwood, Valentine's son. Harm him again and we destroy you. Neither Jace Lightwood nor the fire in his veins will save you, Cleophas, Sebastian said, sword still in hand. His voice was steady. The Nephilim have no savior. You did not know to fear the heavenly fire. Now you do, said Cleophas. Time to retreat, boy. The tip of the Morgenstern sword lowered towards Jace, lowered, and with a cry Sebastian lunged forward. The sword whistled past Jace and buried itself in the earth. The earth seemed to howl as if mortally wounded. A tremor ripped through the ground, spreading out from the tip of the Morgenstern sword. Jace's vision was coming and going, consciousness bleeding out of him like the fire that bled from his wound. But even as the darkness came down, he saw the triumph on Sebastian's face, and heard him begin to laugh as with a sudden terrible wrenching the earth tore itself apart. A great black rift opened beside them. Sebastian leaped into it and vanished.
It's not that simple, Alec, Gia said tiredly. Portal magic is complicated, and we've heard nothing from the Iron Sisters to indicate that they need our assistance. Besides, after what happened in London earlier today, we need to be here, on alert.
I'm telling you, I know, Alec said. He was shivering despite his gear. It was cold on the Guard Hill, but it was more than that. In part, it was shock at what Isabel had said to his parents, at the look on his father's face. But more of it was apprehension. Cold foreboding was dripping down his spine like ice. You don't understand the Indarkened. You don't understand what they're like. He doubled over. Something hot had lanced through him, through his shoulder, down through his guts, like a spear of fire. He hit the ground on his knees, crying out. Alec! Alec! The consul's hands were on his shoulders. He was distantly aware of his parents running towards him. His vision swam with agony, pain overlapping and doubled because it wasn't his pain at all. The sparks under his ribcage didn't burn in his body, but in someone else's. Jace! He ground out between his teeth. Something's happened. The fire. You have to open a portal, quickly.
Armitis, flat on her back on the ground, laughed.
You won't kill me, she said. You haven't got the backbone.
Clary, breathing hard, nudged the tip of the sword under Armitis's chin. You don't know what I'm capable of.
Look at me.
Armitis's eyes glittered.
Look at me and tell me what you see.
Clary looked, already knowing. Armitis didn't look exactly like her brother, but she had the same jawline, the same trustworthy blue eyes, the same brown hair touched with grey.
Mercy, Armitis said, raising her hands as if to ward off Clary's blow.
Will you give it to me?
Mercy.
Clary stood frozen, even as Armitis looked up at her with obvious amusement.
Goodness is not kindness. And there is nothing crueler than virtue.
She knew she should cut Armitis's throat, wanted to even. But how could she tell Luke she had killed his sister? Killed his sister while she'd lain on the ground begging for mercy. Clary felt her own hand shake, as if it were disconnected from her body. Around her, the sounds of battle had dimmed. She could hear shouts and murmurs, but didn't dare turn her head away to see what was going on. She was focused on Armitis, on her own grip on the hilt of Heosphorus, on the thin trickle of blood that ran from beneath Armitis's chin where the tip of Clary's sword had pierced the skin. The earth erupted. Clary's boot slipped in the snow and she was flung to the side. She rolled, barely managing not to slice herself on her own blade. The fall knocked the breath from her, but she scrambled back, clutching Heosphorus as the ground shook around her. Earthquake, she thought wildly. She clutched at a rock with her free hand as Armitis rolled to her knees, looking around with a predatory grin. There were screams all around and an awful ripping noise. As Clary stared in horror, the ground tore itself in half, a massive crack opening in the earth. Rocks, dirt, and jagged chunks of ice rained down into the gap as Clary scrambled to get away from it. It was widening quickly, the jagged crack becoming a vast chasm with sheer sides that dropped away into shadow. The ground was beginning to stop shaking. Clary heard Armitis laugh. She looked up and saw the older woman rise to her feet, grinning mockingly at Clary.
"Give my brother all my love," Armitage called, and jumped into the chasm.
Clary jolted to her feet, her heart pounding, and ran to the edge of the crack. She stared down over it. She could see only a few feet of sheer earth and then darkness, and shadows, moving shadows. She turned to see that everywhere across the battlefield the Indarkand were running towards the chasm and leaping into it. They reminded her of Olympic divers, sure and determined, confident of their landing.
The Nephilim were scrambling to get away from the chasm as their red-clad enemies dashed past them, throwing themselves into the pit.
Clary's gaze tracked among them, anxious, looking for one particular black-clad figure, one head of bright hair. She stopped. There, just at the right of the chasm, some distance from her, were a group of women dressed in white. The Iron Sisters. Through gaps between them, Clary could see a figure on the ground, and another, this one in parchment robes, bent over him. She broke into a run. She knew she shouldn't run with an unsheathed blade, but she didn't care. She pounded across the snow, darting out of the way of running in dark and weaving through the Nephilim. And here, the snow was bloody and soaked and slippery, but she ran on anyway until she burst through the circle of the Iron Sisters and reached Jace. He was on the ground, and her heart, which had felt as if it were exploding inside her chest, slowed its beating slightly when she saw that his eyes were open. He was very pale, though, and breathing harshly enough that she could hear it. The Silent Brother was kneeling next to him, long, pale fingers unsnapping the gear at Jace's shoulder.
"What's going on?" Clary asked, looking around wildly.
A dozen Iron Sisters gazed back, impassive and silent. There were more Iron Sisters as well, on the other side of the chasm, watching unmoving as the Indarkand threw themselves into it. It was eerie.
"What happened?"
"Sebastian," Jace said through gritted teeth, and she dropped down beside him, across from the Silent Brother, as his gear peeled away and she saw the gash in his shoulder. "Sebastian happened. The wound was weeping fire. Not blood, but fire, tinged gold like the ichor of angels." Clary took a ragged breath and looked up to see Brother Zachariah looking back at her. She caught a single glimpse of his face, all angles and pallor and scars, before he drew a steely from his robe. Instead of setting it to Jace's skin as she would have expected, he set it to his own and carved a rune into his palm. He did it quickly, but Clary could feel the power that came from the rune. It made her shudder.
"Stay still, this will end the hurt,"
he said in his soft, omnidirectional whisper, and placed his hand over the fiery gash on Jace's shoulder. Jace cried out. His body half lifted off the ground, and the fire that had bled like slow tears from his wound rose as if gasoline had been poured on it, searing up Brother Zachariah's arm. Wildfire consumed the parchment sleeve of Zachariah's robe. The Silent Brother jerked away, but not before Clary saw that the blaze was rising, consuming him. In the depths of the flame, as it wavered and crackled, Clary saw a shape, the shape of a rune that looked like two wings joined by a single bar. A rune she had seen before, standing on a rooftop in Manhattan. The first rune not from the Grey Book that she had ever visualized. It flickered and disappeared, so quickly that she wondered if she had imagined it. It seemed to be a rune that appeared to her in times of stress and panic, but what did it mean? Was it meant to be a way to help Jace or Brother Zachariah? The Silent Brother fell back silently into the snow, collapsing like a burned tree, shivering to ashes. A murmur tore through the ranks of the Iron Sisters. Whatever was happening to Brother Zachariah, it wasn't supposed to be happening. Something had gone horribly wrong. The Iron Sisters moved toward their fallen brother. They blocked Clary's view of Zachariah as she reached for Jace. He was bucking and spasming on the ground, his eyes closed, his head tilted back. She looked around wildly. Through the gaps between the Iron Sisters, she could see Brother Zachariah thrashing on the ground. His body was shimmering, sizzling with fire. A cry burst from his throat, a human noise. The cry of a man in pain, not the silent mind whisper of the brothers. Sister Cleophas caught at him, parchment robes and fire, and Clary could hear the sister's voice rising.
"Zachariah, Zachariah."
But he was not the only one wounded. Some of the Nephilim were grouped around Jace, but many of the others were with their injured comrades, administering healing runes, searching their gear for bandages.
"Clary," Jace whispered,
He was trying to struggle up onto his elbows, but they wouldn't hold him.
Brother Zachariah, what's happened? What did I do to him?
Nothing, Jace. Lie still. Clary sheathed her blade and fumbled his steely from his weapons belt with numb fingers. She reached to press the tip to his skin, but he writhed away from her, his body jerking.
No,
he gasped. His eyes were huge and burning gold.
Don't touch me, I'll hurt you too.
You won't. Desperate, she threw herself on top of him, the weight of her body bearing him backwards into the snow. She reached for his shoulder as he twisted under her, his clothes and skin blood slippery and fire hot. Her knees slid to either side of his hips as she threw her full weight against his chest, pinning him down.
Jace, she said. Jace, please.
But his eyes wouldn't focus on her, his hands spasming against the ground.
Jace,
she said, and put the steely to his skin just over his wound. And she was on the ship again with her father, with Valentine, and she was throwing everything she had, every bit of strength, every last atom of will and energy into crafting a rune. A rune that would burn down the world, that would reverse death, that would make the oceans fly up into the sky. Only this time, it was the simplest of runes. The rune every shadow hunter learned in their first year of training. Heal me. The Arazi took shape on Jace's shoulder, the color spiraling from the tip so black that the light coming from the stars and the citadel seemed to vanish into it. Clary could feel her own energy vanishing into it too as she drew. Never had she felt more like the steely was an extension of her own veins, that she was writing in her own blood, as if all the energy in her was being drawn out through her hand and fingers, her vision darkening as she fought to keep the steely steady to finish the rune. The last thing she saw was the great burning whirl of a portal, opening onto the impossible sight of Angel Square before she slid into nothingness.
8. Strength in What Remains. Raphael stood, hands in his pockets, and looked up at the demon towers, shimmering dark red. "Something's going on," he said. "Something unusual." Simon wanted to snap back that the unusual thing that was going on was that he'd just been kidnapped and taken to Idris for the second time in his life, but he was feeling too nauseated. He'd forgotten the way a portal seemed to take you apart when you went through it and reassemble you on the other side with important pieces missing. Also, Raphael was right. Something was going on. Simon had been in Alicante before, and he remembered the roads and the canals, the hill rising over it all with the guard at the top. He remembered that on ordinary nights the streets were quiet, lit by the pale glow of the towers. But there was noise tonight, largely coming from the guard in the hill, where lights were dancing, as if a dozen bonfires had been lit. The demon towers were glowing an eerie red gold. "They changed the color of the towers to convey messages," said Raphael. "Gold for marriages and celebrations. Blue for the accords." "What does red mean?" Simon asked. "Magic," said Raphael. His dark eyes narrowed. "Danger." He turned in a slow circle, looking around the quiet street, the large houses by the canal side. He was about a head shorter than Simon. Simon wondered how old he'd been when he'd been turned. 14? 15? Only a little older than Maureen. Who had turned him? Magnus knew, but had never told. "The Inquisitor's house is there," Raphael said, and pointed at one of the largest of the houses, with a pointed roof and balconies out over the canal. "But it is dark." Simon couldn't deny that fact, though his unbeating heart gave a little leap as he looked at the place. Isabel was living there now. One of those windows was her window. "They must all be up at the guard," he said. "They do that for meetings and things." He had no fond memories of the guard himself, having been imprisoned there by the last Inquisitor. "We could go up there, I guess, see what's going on." "Yes, thank you. I am aware of their meetings and things," Raphael snapped. But he looked uncertain in a way Simon couldn't recall him looking before. "Whatever is happening, it is Shadowhunter business. There is a house, not far from here, that has been granted to the vampire representative on the council. We may go there." "Together?" Simon said. It is a very large house, Raphael said. You will be at one end of it, and I at the other. Simon raised his eyebrows. He wasn't entirely sure what he had expected would happen, but spending the night in a house with Raphael hadn't occurred to him. It wasn't that he thought Raphael was going to kill him in his sleep, but the thought of sharing living quarters with someone who seemed to dislike him intensely and always had was odd. Simon's vision was clear and precise now, one of the few things he really liked about being a vampire, and he could see details even at a distance. He saw her before she could have seen him. She was walking along quickly, her head down, her dark hair in the long braid she often wore it in when fighting. She was in gear, and her boots tapped against the cobblestones as she walked. "You're a heartbreaker, Isabel Lightwood." Simon turned to Raphael. "Go away," he said. Raphael smirked. "La belle Isabel," he said. "It is hopeless, you know, you and she." "Because I'm a vampire and she's a shadow hunter?" "No, she's just, how do you say it? Out of your league?" Isabel was halfway down the street now. Simon gritted his teeth. "Salt my game and I'll stake you. I mean it." Raphael shrugged innocently but didn't move. Simon turned away from him and stepped out of the shadows into the street. Isabel halted instantly, her hand going to the whip coiled at her belt. A moment later, she blinked in shock, her hand dropping, her voice uncertain. "Simon?" Simon felt suddenly awkward. Maybe she wouldn't appreciate his suddenly appearing in Alicante like this. This was her world, not his. "I," he began, but he got no further, because Isabel had launched herself at him and thrown her arms around him, nearly knocking him off his feet. Simon let himself close his eyes and bury his face against her neck. He could feel her heart beating, but violently pushed aside any thoughts of blood. She was soft and strong in his arms, her hair tickling his face, and holding her, he felt normal, wonderfully normal, like any teenage boy in love with a girl. In love. He jerked back with a start and found himself looking at Izzy from a few inches away, her huge dark eyes shining. "I can't believe you're here," she said, breathless. "I was wishing you were, and thinking about how long it would be before I could see you, and, oh my God, what are you wearing?" Simon looked down at his puffy shirt and leather pants. He was vaguely aware of Raphael, somewhere in the shadows, snickering. "It's kind of a long story," he said. "Do you think we could go inside?" Magnus turned the silver box with the initials on it over in his hands, his cat's eyes gleaming in the witch-lit dimness of Amatis's cellar. Jocelyn was gazing at him with a look of curious anxiety. Luke couldn't help thinking about all the times Jocelyn had taken Clary to Magnus's loft when Clary had been a child, all the times the three of them had sat together, an unlikely trio, as Clary grew up and older and began to remember what she was supposed to forget. "Anything?" Jocelyn asked. "You have to give me time," Magnus said, poking the box with a finger. "Magical booby traps, curses, the like. They can be pretty subtly hidden." "Take your time," said Luke, leaning back against a table shoved into a cobwebby corner. Long ago, it had been his mother's kitchen table. He recognized the pattern of careless knife marks across the wooden top, even the dent in one of the legs he'd made when he'd kicked it as a teenager. It had been Amatis's for years. It had been hers when she'd been married to Stephen, and had sometimes hosted dinner parties at the Herondale house. It had been hers after the divorce, after Stephen had moved out to the countryside manor house with his new wife. The whole cellar, in fact, was stacked with old furniture, items Luke recognized as having belonged to their parents, paintings and knick-knacks from the time Amatis had been married. He wondered why she had hidden them away down here. Perhaps she hadn't been able to bear to look at them. "I don't think there's anything wrong with it," Magnus said finally, setting the box back on the shelf where Jocelyn had shoved it, unwilling to have the item in the house, but unwilling to throw it away either. He shivered and rubbed his hands together. He was swathed in a gray and black coat that made him look like a hard-boiled detective. Jocelyn hadn't given him a chance to hang his coat up when he'd arrived on their doorstep, just grabbed him by the arm and dragged him down to the cellar. No snares, no traps, no magic at all. Jocelyn looked a bit sheepish. "Thanks," she said, "for looking at it. I can be a bit paranoid. And after what just happened in London..." "What did happen in London?" "We don't know that much," said Luke. "We got a fire message about it this afternoon from the guard, but not a lot of details. London was one of the few institutes that hadn't emptied yet. Apparently Sebastian and his forces tried to attack. They were rebuffed by some kind of protection spell, something even the council didn't know about. Something that warned the Shadow Hunters what was coming and led them to safety." "A ghost," Magnus said. A smile hovered around his mouth. "A spirit, sworn to protect the place. She's been there for 130 years. "She," Jocelyn said, leaning back against the dusty wall. "A ghost, really, what was her name?" "You would recognize her last name, if I told it to you. But she wouldn't like that." Magnus's gaze was far away. "I hope this means she's found peace." He snapped back to attention. "Anyway," he said, "I hadn't meant to drag the conversation in this direction. It isn't why I came to you." "I guessed as much," said Luke. "We appreciate the visit, though I admit I was surprised to see you on our doorstep. It's not where I thought you'd go." "I thought you'd go to the Lightwoods," hung in the air between them, unsaid. "I had a life before Alec," Magnus snapped. "I'm the High Warlock of Brooklyn. I am here to take a council seat on behalf of Lilith's children." "I thought Katarina Loss was the warlock representative," said Luke, surprised. "She was," Magnus admitted. "She made me take her place so I could come here and see Alec." He sighed. "She, in fact, made this particular pitch to me while we were in the Hunter's Moon. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about." Luke sat down on the rickety table. "Did you see Bat?" he asked. "Bat tended to set up office in the Hunter's Moon during the days, rather than the police station. It was unofficial, but everyone knew that was where to find him." "Yes. He'd just gotten a call from Maya." Magnus ran a hand through his black hair. "Sebastian doesn't exactly appreciate being rebuffed," he said slowly. And Luke felt his nerves tighten. Magnus was clearly hesitant to impart bad news. "It looks like after he attempted to attack the London Institute and was unsuccessful, he turned his attention to the Praetor Lupus. Apparently he doesn't have much use for lycanthropes. Can't turn them into Endarkened. So he burned the place to the ground and murdered them all. He killed Jordan Kyle in front of Maya. He let her live so she could deliver a message." Jocelyn hugged her arms around herself. "My God." "What was the message?" Luke said, finding his voice. "It was a message to Downworlders," said Magnus. "I talked to Maya on the phone. She had me memorize it. Apparently," he said, "tell all the Downworlders that I am in pursuit of vengeance, and I will have it. I will deal this way with any who ally themselves with Shadowhunters. I have no argument with your kind unless you follow the Nephilim into battle, in which case you will be food for my blade and the blades of my army until the last of you is cut from the surface of this world." Jocelyn made a ragged sound. "He sounds just like his father, doesn't he?" Luke looked at Magnus. "Are you going to deliver that message to the council?" Magnus tapped at his chin with a glittery fingernail. "No," he said. "But I'm not going to conceal it from the Downworlders either. My loyalty is not to Shadowhunters over them. Not like yours." The words hung between them unspoken. "I have this," Magnus said, taking a piece of paper from his pocket. Luke recognized it, since he had one of his own. "Will you be at the dinner tomorrow night?" "I will. Fairies take invitations like that very seriously. Meliorn and the court would be insulted if I didn't go." "I plan to tell them then," Magnus said. "And if they panic," said Luke, "if they abandon the council and the Nephilim, it's not as if what happened to the Praetor can be concealed." "Sebastian's message could," said Jocelyn.
He's trying to frighten the Downworlders, Magnus. He's trying to make them stand back while he destroys the Nephilim.
It would be their right, said Magnus.
If they do, do you think that the Nephilim will ever forgive them?
Said Jocelyn.
The Clave is not forgiving. They are more unforgiving than God himself.
Jocelyn, said Luke, it's not Magnus's fault. But Jocelyn was still looking at Magnus.
What, she said, would Tessa tell you to do?
Please, Jocelyn, Magnus said, you hardly know her. She would preach honesty, she usually does. Concealing the truth never works. When you live long enough, you can see that. Jocelyn looked down at her hands, her artist's hands that Luke had always loved, agile and careful and stained with ink.
I'm not a shadow hunter anymore, she said. I fled from them. I told you both that. But a world without shadow hunters in it. I am afraid of that.
There was a world before the Nephilim, said Magnus. There will be one after.
A world we can survive in.
My son, Jocelyn began, and broke off as a hammering sound came from upstairs. Someone was pounding on the front door.
Clary, she wondered aloud. She might have forgotten her key again.
I'll get it, Luke said, and stood up. He exchanged a brief look with Jocelyn as he left the cellar, his mind whirling. Jordan dead, Maya grieving. Sebastian trying to pit Downworlders against Shadowhunters. He drew the front door open, and a blast of cold night air came in. Standing on the doorstep was a young woman with pale, curling blonde hair, dressed in gear. Helen Blackthorne. Luke barely had time to register that the demon towers above them were glowing blood red when she spoke.
I've come with a message from the guard, she said. It's about Clary.
Maya. A soft voice out of the silence. Maya turned over, not wanting to open her eyes. There was something terrible waiting out there in the darkness, something that she could escape if she just slept and slept forever. Maya. He was looking at her out of the shadows, pale eyes and dark skin. Her brother, Daniel. As she watched, he tore the wings from a butterfly and let its body fall, twitching to the ground. Maya, please. A light touch on her arm. She bolted upright, her whole body recoiling. Her back hit a wall as she gasped, peeling her eyes open. They were sticky, her eyelashes fringed with salt. She'd been crying in her sleep. She was in a half-lit room, a single window looking out onto a winding downtown street. She could see the leafless boughs of trees through the smeared glass and the edge of something metal, a fire escape, she guessed. She glanced down, a narrow bed with an iron headboard and a thin blanket that she had kicked to the foot. Her back against a brick wall. A single chair by the bed, old and splintered. Bat sat in it, his eyes wide, slowly lowering his hand. I'm sorry, he said.
Don't, she ground out. Don't touch me.
You were screaming, he said, in your sleep. She hugged her arms around herself. She was wearing jeans and a tank top. The sweater she had been wearing on Long Island was missing, and the skin on her arms prickled with goose flesh.
Where are my clothes? She said. My jacket, my sweater.
Bat cleared his throat. They were covered in blood, Maya.
Right, she said. Her heart was drumming in her chest. You remember what happened? He asked.
She closed her eyes. She remembered it all. The drive, the truck, the burning building, the beach covered in bodies. Jordan collapsing against her, his blood running down on and around her like water mixing with the sand. Your boyfriend's dead.
Jordan, she said, though she already knew.
Bat's face was grave. There was a greenish cast to his brown eyes that made them shine in the half-light. It was a face she knew well. He was one of the first werewolves she'd ever met. They dated until she told him she thought she was too new to the city, too jittery, too much not over Jordan for a relationship. He'd broken up with her the next day. Surprisingly, they had stayed friends. He's dead, he said, along with almost all the Praetor Lupus. Praetor scarred the students, a few survived.
Maya, why were you there? What were you doing at the Praetor? Maya told him about Simon's